Tim Chapman is a Northern Irish expert on restorative justice. He teaches a master's programme on it at the University of Ulster, and he's chair of the board of the European Forum for Restorative Justice. As in New Zealand, restorative justice is, in Northern Ireland, largely confined to juveniles. Northern Ireland was poised to expand it into the adult system, but the government's been suspended since last year. Tim Chapman addressed a conference this past week on restorative approaches in the prisons to try to get those very high inmate numbers down in New Zealand. So at this stage, I wondered what Tim Chapman's take on the situation with restorative justice is in Northern Ireland, given that in New Zealand it's confined to diversion and pre-sentence for adults.
We have a system that intervenes at every stage. So there's restorative practices that are there to prevent people, certainly, from getting involved in crime. There's practices that are there to divert people from prosecution. There are post-sentence restorative justice.
And this is for adults?
It's less for adults than for juveniles, I have to say. With right. juveniles, we have a comprehensive system similar to New Zealand. But for adults, it's a bit more ad hoc. It just depends on whether the judge is a proponent or not. And whether there is a sort of local scheme available. So it's a bit more ad hoc. The juveniles is very systematic.
In fact, you were informed by a New Zealand system.
Yes.
With youth in terms of what you do in Ireland, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, the history was that as part of actually coming out of the conflict, we had a criminal justice review. And part of that was to look at our youth justice system. And we had a group of experts who travelled the world and decided that New Zealand was the best. So we modelled ours on New Zealand with local adaptations, but basically a restorative conference approach. And that has proved incredibly successful, really has.
How do you judge its success?
High levels of victim participation and satisfaction, primarily. Better rates of reducing reoffending than, for instance, I used to be a probation officer, so...
I mean, that's the issue, isn't it, to reduce reoffending? It's all very well for the victim to feel better, but yeah. You want to reduce the number of victims.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody wants to reduce reoffending. I don't think that's the main purpose of restorative justice. I think the main purpose is to clear up the mess that has been made by that offence, to make sure that the victim is satisfied and doesn't have to suffer, you know, more than necessary. For me, that's the core of it. But one of the very pleasant side effects of it is that a person who's offended, who's experienced a restorative process, is more likely to stop than for most other things, you know. And the research in Northern Ireland has borne that out. It's not perfect. People still do reoffend, but at a lower level than for what I used to do, supervise on probation or community service or custody. It's better than all those.
So what did your nearly 25 years in the probation service teach you about how these things should go?
I tell you what I learned towards the end of it was that by over-focusing on offenders, you're selling the system short. You're ignoring the impact of crime on, obviously, the victims' families, and the community. Your focus is far too narrow. So when people say, you know, let's get tough on crime, usually what they mean is let's get tough on people who commit crime.
In order to deter the others.
Yeah. But a lot of the evidence is saying that that doesn't work to deter. It actually just... It makes people less responsible, to be honest. You know, the system says if you've committed a crime or you're suspected of a crime, say nothing. Get a lawyer. Get them to speak for you. Get a lawyer to see if they can get you off or else a lighter sentence. So it really encourages a lack of responsibility, and also it encourages offenders to sort of feel sorry for themselves if they're punished. I want offenders to feel sorry for the people they've hurt. I want them to feel that they need to have a better relationship with their community. And not take all the time, but sort of give. And I think restorative justice changes that. Changes
if they're capable of it. And not everybody is.
Well, not everybody's capable of anything, I guess. But we have a law that says every single young person, for instance, must be offered the opportunity to meet their victim. And well over 90% agree to do it.
How many victims agree to it?
About, this is a complicated question. In our law, every single crime, except for murder and terrorist offences, is included. Some crimes don't have direct victims. I go outside in the street and write my name on the wall. There isn't an individual person that gets hurt, but it's a civic thing.
Yep.
So you have maybe the victim then is the representative of the council or something, or that street. So we don't count them as direct victims. So in terms of direct victims, 50% of our conferences have direct victims.
And you're still talking about youth?
Yeah.
Offending, right? Yeah.
For adults, it's going to be higher because it's more selective. For adults, you're going to select cases that are particularly suitable for restorative justice. So there will be a direct victim. So it's actually higher, but then we're not doing as many, if you understand.
Mm. Should you be doing more? I mean, if your theory is right about restorative justice working, why isn't it extended more widely into the adult offending?
I think that people don't fully understand it. There is a political culture that is scared of taking risks in this area, even though, you know, in Northern Ireland it's now accepted completely. There's nobody sort of opposing it. There's a lot of vested professional interest, to be honest. When we introduced it in Northern Ireland, lawyers were worried that they were going to get less work because we were diverting a lot of young people from court and from crime. Judges were annoyed because they didn't have the full discretion to order what they wanted. Even social workers didn't like it because the thing about restorative justice, it says ordinary people have the intelligence and knowledge to make decisions about important things. You don't always need the professional like myself saying, this is what the problem is and this is what you should do. Ordinary people have the sense to say, look, you harmed me. This is what I need you to do to make me feel better and to help me to move on with my life. And usually they come up with really interesting ideas. You know, they have a pet charity. They don't particularly want money back, but they'll say to an adult or a young person, I need you to work for this charity. Or I need you to come to this day centre for the elderly and help out for a while because I'm an old person. You don't understand how vulnerable I feel when somebody breaks into my house or whatever. So that's means that there's a lot of obstacles in the way of developing a completely new way of thinking about crime and how it should be dealt with.
Just to clarify, is the way that restorative justice works in Northern Ireland pretty much the same as it works here?
It's based on the New Zealand model, but I think what I think the strength of the New Zealand model, it's very child-centred and family-centred in the widest sense, drawing on the Maori tradition. We wanted also to bring the victim in more. Our society is quite punitive, and we felt if we can satisfy the victims, if they feel respected and heard by the system, that is going to reduce the need for punishment. And it's proved. We used to be a country where we sent an awful lot of children into residential and secure institutions, like hundreds. At the moment in Northern Ireland, there is between 5 or 7 young people who have been sentenced to custody under the age of 18. It's been a dramatic change. And one of the reasons is if victims are treated with respect and feel that they have an experience of justice, i.e. somebody has been made accountable, they've been able to explain the impact of what this person's action and ask them to do something to show, A, that they're sorry, and B, that they're not going to do it again. Victims don't want anything more, and they tell the court that. And the court then has the courage to say, well, we're not going to lock you up, whereas they might have previously.
So in the long run, it should be reducing your population in the prisons.
Yes.
Which, of course, is what we're after.
I think it will reduce the number of people coming into the system in the first place. And, you know, And then if they're not in the system, they're less likely to end up in prison. And that's been our experience with juveniles. And but for adults, we do have a much lower level of imprisonment, say, for than the rest of the UK.
Do you?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. I think it is we have in Northern Ireland still a strong sense of community. And we...
Even though you fight a lot.
Well,
which community are you talking about?
You see, this is the contradiction, because there's something about conflict that makes community stronger.
I know. Yeah. Community building exercises.
Yeah. And also in Northern Ireland, I think we have a tradition of sort of self-help. You know, there's community organisations. We're not always relying on the state, not always calling for the police, you know. And it's partly because...
Because you don't trust the police.
Exactly. There's a history of distrust. So people have had to develop their own alternatives.
The silver lining.
Yeah. Now, some of those alternatives are brutal. We had paramilitary organisations that used to shoot young people who stole cars.
Kneecapping.
Yes.
Not recommended.
Not recommended. But interesting, what emerged out of that, once they realised that, you know, this wasn't effective, actually. If anybody ever says we need to be really tough on young people, quote, kneecapping in Belfast, it wasn't effective. And obviously it was abusive.
He hastily added.
Yes. Restorative justice emerged from that as an alternative. So a lot of those communities that used to be really punitive are now engaging in a restorative way with young people.
Okay.
And adults.
So restorative justice actually grew up in Northern Ireland ahead of the system.
Mm.
Which
it
you
came
could
from
argue.
The community, yeah.
You could well argue in New Zealand as well. I mean, yeah. Maori had been saying that, you know, they used to do it that way. They didn't have prisons.
Yes.
They would deal with the offender in a restorative way.
Yeah, yeah. I think something similar, certainly when I was at this conference for the last couple of days, I could connect with a lot of the Maori stories from an Irish perspective. The sense of community, the sense of family. And I think, you know, although it's weakening, there's still a strong sense of sort of spirituality and religion within Ireland, probably more so than the rest of Britain. So there's sort of those sort of things that bind people together, and that helps a restorative response to harm and conflict.
Mm.
Yeah.
You're talking about Catholicism,
mm-hmm.
but the Protestants, do they have the same sense of community?
It's a good question, though, because, yes, you've got one community that is bound together by one church. It has to be said that church is getting weaker because of all the scandals.
Well, that's right, but it's also an expression of political position
as
well.
It is, and it's unifying as well, because, you know, you're all going to the same church. Whereas in the Protestant communities, there's 100 different Protestant churches. It's a much more individualistic way of living.
And also, to a certain extent, Catholics in Northern Ireland are bound together by the sense of being collective victims, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. Although that's changed, I must say, because I think the reforms have really created a much more confident Catholic population. And ironically, it's the Protestant working class that now have fallen behind. But there are, I'm as part of the university, working actively with various community groups within the Protestant community to develop restorative. They've been a bit behind, but they're catching up, and they want to embrace this idea as well.
Mm. You did a lot of work in West Belfast.
Yes.
With the IRA.
Yeah.
Post-1998, presumably.
Well, I was a probation officer in West Belfast, the most difficult times, you know, the hunger strikes, the succession of events after the Gibraltar killings and things like that. So I would have been there at the time when the IRA were shooting my clients. People on probation were going up the road to be shot. They made appointments. You know, it was like being on probation. So a young person would come in to report to me and say, look, I can't stay too long because I've got to go up the road for an appointment with the IRA. And this was a euphemism that they've said, come up at 2 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon and we'll shoot you once. If you don't come up on Tuesday, we'll catch you and we'll shoot you twice.
Where would they shoot them once?
In the knees? Or,
aye.
Yeah. Take them down an alleyway, you know, behind houses and shoot them. And then if they were lucky, they would call an ambulance so that they would be rescued.
How did you deal with that?
I got very angry about it. It was abusive, and I would have made representations to the IRA directly to protest against this. And we started to have a conversation to try and persuade them that this was not a good thing to do. And gradually it reduced. So,
as a consequence of conversation?
Well, I mean, it wasn't just me. It was a lot of pressures. I mean, in the 90s, moving towards the peace process, I think the IRA and the Sinn Féin were realising we're going to have to sort of become political, not just military. And, of course, they were pushing a human rights agenda. And it doesn't look good if you're pushing a human rights agenda and you're shooting 14-year-olds. So they were beginning to change their view and to develop a sort of political respectability in preparation for the peace process. So all those things came together. And the fact that it wasn't working, you know, that we had people on probation coming in on crutches and they couldn't wait to steal a car and drive it up to the local IRA boss's house and, you know, screech around outside his house in defiance.
Really?
Yeah, oh, they were very defiant. I mean, to them, the IRA was just another form of policing that they hated.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. So the IRA thought that they had a hold on the population when, in fact, they were losing the population.
Well, I think they were in danger of losing the population. I mean, I don't underestimate that a lot of the population supported the IRA. There was no doubt about that. They couldn't have existed if there weren't a lot of people there to protect them and not inform the police or the British Army where they were and how they could be caught. So they did have a lot of credibility, but they were preparing for a new phase in their struggle, moving away from the outright military towards the political, as you know, in the mid to late 90s, then we had a peace process, and Martin McGuinness ended up being the deputy first minister, an ex-IRA leader, you know, working with Ian Paisley, who was the extreme Protestant. So it was a remarkable process that took place.
Did you see that movie that was made?
The Trip, was it? Yeah, The Journey.
Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley.
Yes, I did. I did. Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, it was sort of fictitious,
sure.
But it was about.
It was a little parable in a way.
And they did have a relationship.
Brendan Gleeson played Martin McGuinness.
That's right.
And I remember Gleeson's, because you know how you say, we're going to do this, sure we are.
Yeah.
Or we did that, sure we did. Martin McGuinness's character says, how would that be if the world had been ruled by the Northern Irish? We're going to put a man on the moon, so we are. It's a kind of a reinforcer that makes people laugh.
That's right. That's what we do.
Anywho, I digress. Yeah. How's the peace process gone now?
Well, we're a bit stuck, it's got to be said.
Mm-hmm. I think Brexit stuck you a bit, has it not?
Brexit has not helped. It has been very destabilising politically. It has resurrected the issue of the border, which had sort of quietly gone away, because if you're in the, you know, European Union, borders don't matter. So people were happy. We just drive up. There's a lovely road between Belfast and Dublin. You can get down the road in an hour and a half. And so if you're a nationalist, you don't really feel I'm separate from the rest of Ireland like in the old days. And the peace process really embedded human rights and equality of opportunity. So the Catholic population were doing well and things were going well. And then Brexit comes along and suddenly the border's an issue. The sort of more right-wing Protestant party, the DUP, supported Brexit and got into an argument with the nationalists over the Irish Language Act, which they wanted to have an Irish Language Act to give equal respect to the Irish language as the English language, which ironically is the same in Wales and Scotland with their languages, but the Protestant Party refused to support that. And so we haven't had a government in Northern Ireland since January 2017, nearly 2 years. So we're in a bit of a mess, and I don't think it'll be resolved until Brexit is resolved.
And who knows how that's going to be resolved?
Nobody knows. It's a mess.
I mean, the border, if the border were to come back, that would be a psychological issue, are you saying, rather more than any particular ramification for Ireland?
Yeah, it is a psychological and a sort of political issue, but it's more symbolic politically. I mean, there's good relationships between the North and South. The economy is very integrated. You know, if you're a farmer, you've got your cattle on one side of the border, you're milking them, and then you're taking them across the border for the milk to be refined or whatever you do with milk, made into cheese. And so it's very integrated. You know, businesses are crossing the border every day.
Yeah.
Now, if it became a hard border and there were issues of tariffs and customs and things like that, there would have to be some form of checks. And that would just be symbolic if people were waving you down, as they used to do during the conflict. You know, there was always a queue at the border to be, people were searched, and it would just bring that bad feeling that we're divided again.
Yeah.
And it would encourage the small group that exists in Northern Ireland who don't think the war is over, what we call the dissident Republicans, and they're still capable of violence. So it would encourage them, and it would give them more support.
Mm.
There would probably be within the next 5 years a referendum to see whether we should unite with the rest of Ireland. So ironically, Brexit, which was about taking the power back, could actually lead to the breakup of the United Kingdom, you know, because Scotland's independence movement will be heartened by Brexit, as will Irish nationalism. So it just means things are very uncertain and unstable. We could do without it.
Interesting that Northern Ireland voted to stay with the European Union.
That's true, yeah. Good majority, about 56% wanted to stay.
Mm.
And Scotland was even higher, but we're stuck.
Well, you get a lot of money from the EU,
yeah.
Right?
The EU has been very good, very supportive of the peace process. You know, it's put a lot of money into good projects and developing the economy.
Have there been good projects? Because the usual criticism of the EU is it tosses money into, you know, stupid things, roads that don't go anywhere and bridges that aren't used. And
I wouldn't have been aware. I mean, there's been a few silly projects as well, but nothing that substantial. You know, generally, they've supported infrastructure, they've supported jobs, and they've supported a lot of work around peace building and sort of encouraging people to share their cultures, to meet, to talk at a ground level. So it's... I think generally people think the EU has been a positive influence in the whole of Ireland. I mean, the south of Ireland benefited hugely from the EU.
I'm talking to Tim Chapman, who's a Northern Irish expert on restorative justice. When it comes to restorative justice and the principle, the overall philosophy of restorative justice, does Ireland have anything like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Northern Ireland, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in that... You know, there are people who will not forgive the atrocities committed on both sides.
There's been a lot of talk about it. This is what we're sort of a bit stuck at. We've had a lot of good political and institutional reform. But what we're left with are relationships, which politics isn't so good at. Just how do people live together? And as you say, the legacy of there's thousands of people who are victims and the perpetrator of the murder of their husband or father has never been brought to justice, and they continue to suffer.
And they will have a clear idea of who was responsible.
Very often. And also know that for political purposes, those people are not being pursued.
Yeah.
Deals have been made in order to keep the peace. Or people who were imprisoned were let out early. So there's a lot of hurt for people.
You think that there was a good reason for those political deals? Or are you saying that it was corrupt?
I'm not sure if it was corrupt. I think there was pragmatic reasons. Tony Blair was the Prime Minister at the time, and he's a clever and he's a pragmatic politician. And I think he was willing to make deals with the IRA if they would stop the violence. And they did. So there has been very little violence. So you've got to be grateful for that. There hasn't been many more victims. There have been a few, but there haven't been many more since then. So that is a huge win. But it leaves a lot of very bad taste in your mouth. I mean, there's people that know that my father was killed by that person and he has been protected by the state. Not hunted by the state, but protected.
The price of peace.
The price of peace. So, I was lucky. I lived throughout the Troubles. Nobody close to me suffered. It's easy for me to say, look, let's move on. Nobody's killing each other. But I wonder how I would feel if, you know, my father or my brother had been killed and nothing was ever done about it, and nothing was ever going to be done. I'm not sure about... There's been talk about Truth and Reconciliation Commissions and things like that. I'm not sure because I just think if it's public, people will politicize it. For me...
At this stage, you mean?
Yeah. For me, the restorative process works well if it's private and nobody has a political axe to grind. They just want to say, can we sort out this business? Can we talk so we come to some sort of understanding and agreement on how we go on from now?
We're talking about a country that remembers the Battle of the Boyne, right?
Exactly. We
have so time memories. Is not going to heal this, is
no,
it?
No, it's sort of, you know, time... I suppose, deadens it a bit and reduces the pain. But it could be two or three generations. I've just been doing some research and talking to ex-combatants, as we call them now, people who were active in the conflict and have now, if you like, retired. And they have a lot of regrets, but they talk about their grandchildren and hoping their grandchildren won't have to go through it. They can already see that their own children are still affected, even though they were born after the peace agreement. But they're hoping maybe the grandchildren will not have to deal with the things that they had to deal with. So you hope that time is going to make things better.
Why have you been talking to ex-combatants?
Well, it was just a bit of research I was commissioned to do. It was to do an oral history of a group of ex-paramilitaries who had been involved in a particular event which was significant in East Belfast. There was a general strike in 1974. It was called the Ulster Workers' Council strike. It was quite dramatic. It was at that stage, all the key manufacturing industries were dominated by the Protestants. They got the best jobs. So they wanted to protest against a power-sharing agreement that was set up by the British government in 1974. And they brought the country to a standstill for 2 weeks, and the British government relented. So it was an exercise of, if you like, working-class power, organised working-class power, that exceeded in its goal. The problem was it was a protest movement. They didn't have a solution or a programme for improvement or to address the problems. And that then quickly deteriorated just into paramilitary violence of a sectarian nature. You know, the strategy was to kill Catholics, basically. So I'm just doing an oral history of that time, which is a very significant moment in sort of Protestant working class history.
This is interesting. I mean, it goes beyond your day job, does it?
Yes, it does. It does, although... One of the things about restorative justice is the importance of stories, the importance of listening to the story of both the perpetrator and the victim.
I think you've described it as thickening.
Yes.
Thickening the thing out. The thin story is good and bad, victim and villain. You thicken it out.
And that's exactly what I find in these oral histories, you know, that these people who have committed serious offences and done prison for them also have other sides to them and other actually sympathies with, you know, Catholic friends in the past and things like that. So that's exactly what I'm interested in, that helping people to thicken the story of conflict or harm in a way that isn't just sort of the newspaper headline of good and bad, you know, villain, victim, that it's more complex than that. And that's what interests me in restorative justice, that when two people sit down to talk about something difficult and hurtful, they usually leave the room with a greater sense of commonality than when they came in.
Sometimes, do you think the victim feels as if he or she is being asked to shoulder some weight? You know, it's quite you've been done over in some way or another, and now they want me to go and help out with this bastard who did it.
Yes, and I think restorative justice can be criticised quite rightly for that. The way we try and teach people to do it at our university is to say the victim comes for their own needs. Do not say it would be good for the young fella. come because you want to give off about something or you want to ask questions. Often it's the questions that motivate them to come. I just want to understand, why did you do it? What made you think it was okay to enter my house to steal stuff? Or are you going to do it again? Or is it something personal you've got against me? These sort of questions that sort of torment victims because the system doesn't give them the opportunity to ask those questions. So it's...
And do they feel better if they hear that?
Yeah.
The offender, you know, had a terrible childhood and was beaten and...
Yeah.
What?
I mean, that does some... It's amazing how altruistic victims can be once they have been given respect. But...
Who's going to give them that respect?
It has to be the offender.
And how do you persuade an offender to give a victim respect when... You know, often if we talk about the troubles, right?
Yeah.
If you committed an atrocity, you justified that by having been treated badly.
Yeah,
it's them and us.
Yeah,
and the offender may well have that idea as well, right?
Yes. I mean, certainly, my understanding of why people offend is often because they've experienced harms in their lives. They've experienced injustices as they see it. And partly it's a way of dealing with that, that they start to hurt other people. But actually, if people listen to each other's stories, what you find, if it goes well, and it doesn't always go well, you know, we would say 9 times out of 10 it goes well, but that 10% of victims walk out unhappy. But 90% is what we hold on to.
To concentrate on the negative, but what are they unhappy about as a rule?
The attitude of the offender.
Okay.
And some offenders, in spite of volunteering to come, in spite of the preparation they've got, do have a bad attitude. Or sometimes they come across, you know, it's like a lot of people who are sort of on the street, they have a certain attitude on the surface. You know, they want to be tough guys and... all that. They probably underneath that, they're frightened. But they just seem that they're not that remorseful. They're a bit offhand. Yeah, I'll do. What do you want me to do? You know, and the victim says, you're not really serious about this, are you? Oh, yeah. Mm. And so they just think, oh, no. Some victims come with unrealistic. There was one, like, businessman who a couple of kids had... lit a fire and burnt down his warehouse, and it was cost hundreds of thousands of pounds, and he wanted full compensation. Now he's never going to get that, and he was probably insured anyway. But that's, he said, you know, you're not taking this seriously. You don't realise what you've done, and I'm getting no money back from you. And so he wasn't happy. But as I say, 9 times out of 10, if you sit down with somebody and you listen, you see them as a human being, not the monster that you had in your mind. And you understand their way of thinking. And I've literally had victims. Can I have time for a quick story? This young fella, at a loose end, was hanging around outside a club. And he saw the beer delivery lorry come up to unload beer. So he waited till they weren't looking and he grabbed a crate of beer and went off with it. And he was caught. So he had a conference, he brought his parents, and he had a conference with the owner of the club and the manager of the club. And he convinced the owner that he was really remorseful. He came from a pretty decent family who made no excuses for him, just said he's at a loose end, he's got no work, he's bored and he's doing stupid things. And towards the end of the conference, the club owner said, do you mind if we ask this young fellow to leave the room for a while? I want to talk to his parents. So this is unusual, but we thought, well, it's going well. Let's go for it. So the young man left the room and he said, I tell you what, I'm quite impressed with your son. He's really faced up to this. He's made no excuses. I believe he is sorry for what he did, and I believe he knows he's made a big mistake. And the reason I've asked him to leave is I want to ask you, what would you think if I offered him a job? And I said, this is exactly what he needs. And he says, well, no, hold on a minute. It's a club. There's alcohol. And I have a zero tolerance policy towards drugs, but I would be a liar if I said there's no drugs in my club. So you need to understand there's risks involved. And they said, nevertheless, this is what he needs. So he was called in and he said to the young fella, do you want a job? And he said, yeah. Gave him the job. Afterwards, we were sitting discussing this, you know, just once everything had been tidied up. And the father of the night said, would you mind telling me why you offered my son a job? And he said, well, I'll tell you a story. Our family have always been in the pub trade in Belfast. And my father used to tell us, you know, on a, sitting down to dinner, this story, that he was clearing up in the pub one night and he found a wee fella hiding. He was obviously hiding, waiting for him to leave so he could steal stuff. He grabbed him, called the police, and while he was waiting for the police to arrive, he was chatting to him. And he said to us, I saw something in this young person that was good, and I offered him a job. So this had been a story that had been passed out. And then he turned around and he said, do you see this, my manager? That was the wee fella that my father caught, and I would trust him with my last penny. So I'm just thinking, maybe your son is going to be that. Maybe he's going to be the manager of the club in 20 years' time. So that's the power of the story, that the humanity of sort of just people meeting, talking about something, and if the young person takes responsibility or the adult shows remorse, it's incredible how altruistic and non-punitive the people who have suffered can be.
What do you think the chances are of getting the restorative justice into the adult system more? Because it's, as you say, it's more challenging and people tend to think, well, we'll give the young people a chance, but at that age they should know better and they've run out of chances.
Yeah, it's a political decision and politicians don't like to take too many risks around law and order.
I mean, we do have quite a lobby here of, you know, the tough on crime lobby, as you will too.
Yeah. Well, I think restorative justice is tough on crime. In terms of the actual harm and suffering crime costs, I don't think courts really deal with that. They are tough on the person who's committed the crime. But I think, ironically, it works better with adults, because what we know about teenagers is they go through this period of being incredibly self-centred. They find it very difficult to understand how their behaviour. I've had three teenagers in my family and I know what they're like. They can be so self-centred. They don't understand their impact. They have lower levels of empathy and responsibility because they're still growing up. Adults, in my experience, have a certain amount, even adult defenders, have a certain amount of maturity that they can take responsibility and they can understand other people's point of view. So theoretically, it should work a lot better with adults than with teenagers. So I think if it was introduced in a sort of wholehearted way, I think you'd be quite surprised at the success of it.
I mean, is there any evidence from overseas as to whether it reduces recidivism?
Yes.
Because that's the issue here. We pay $110,000 a year for every inmate in our prison, and we've got a very, very high prison population, unlike you. But we would very much like to cut that cost.
Yeah.
But we're not convinced, I think, by whether restorative justice would reduce recidivism.
There's been a lot of studies, and almost everyone says it does reduce recidivism. Probably the most rigorous one was commissioned by the Home Office in London. Very reputable academics, led by Joanna Shapland, a professor in Sheffield. And they looked in a very controlled way at a similar group who had received restorative justice and a similar group that didn't.
Are we talking about juveniles or adults?
Adults. These are adults.
Yes.
And they were serious enough offenders too. And what they found, there was a significant reduction in crime. Now, when I say significant, it was 15%. So the group that had done restorative justice committed 15% less offences than the group that hadn't. And the Home Office accepted that. And also what interested the Home Office, they did a sort of cost-benefit analysis and found that for every pound that was spent on the restorative justice process, £9 was saved within the criminal justice system as a whole. So it had better results and it was cheaper. And for me, I think if you say better results in reducing reoffending, it's cheaper. And most importantly, it satisfies victims' need for justice. Those three things, I think, are the selling points. It has to be done well. It can't be done on the cheap. People need to be well trained. There needs to be good standards of practice. There needs to be safeguards for victims and for offenders so that the process is not in any way abused or people are unsafe in it. But if it's done really well, there is no doubt it's going to have an impact. It's going to reduce crime and it's going to reduce imprisonment. And it's going to reduce the amount of money we spend on the system.
So, as you say, it's a political reluctance to put it into place.
Yeah. That's the big problem.
Possibly also, I don't know, possibly also because it'll be a big payment up front.
Yes.
And governments are in for 3 or 4 years.
Mm. We were lucky in Northern Ireland that it was coming out of the peace process. There was a peace dividend. So the government wanted to invest in something new and they wanted it to work. So they were generous. Not so much now because we went through a recession, but at the beginning we did have the resources. So that's, I would say two things. Invest in it at the beginning. I mean, it's still not as expensive as courts and prisons. If politicians are very nervous, pilot it. Take one city in New Zealand and pilot it there. And get
is that what you're doing?
This is what we did in Northern Ireland. We started it in Belfast and in a rural area for 2 years, and we got independent academics to evaluate it. It was evaluated very positively, and then the government said, OK, we'll do it for all of Northern Ireland. So that helped the politicians, you know, to just not jump in at the deep end, but test it out.
I'm talking to Tim Chapman about restorative justice. So what proportion of adult offenders in Northern Ireland get restorative justice procedures?
I can't give you a percentage, but it's low compared to juveniles.
All right.
We were just about to get a new policy and legislation when our government collapsed. So we've been building up to this, and we should have been at the moment full flight, but
I see.
It's all been shelved.
It became interrupted.
Yeah. Hopefully, when we get a government back, it'll be implemented.
If ever you get a government back.
If we ever get a government back.
What's you've been involved in a project called Alternative, the Alternative Project. What is that?
That was an interesting one. It was a European project that was partnered with Serbia, Austria, Hungary, Norway, Belgium. And we were looking at the phenomenon in Europe that's becoming fairly serious is that the unease that people have about migration and refugees, what we called intercultural conflict. So, for instance, in Vienna, there was tensions between an Islamic Turkish community and local people in this social housing. In Northern Ireland, it was the classic Catholic Protestant thing, but also we have an influx of migrants as well, and there's been an upturn in hate crime. So we looked at, can restorative justice help with that? And this was very much outside of the system within the community. We trained activists within the community in restorative practices so that they could see problems before they became major and could intervene and get people talking. So, for instance, there was one case in a working-class area in Belfast where there was an Eastern European family living beside a local family. And they were in disputes about rubbish was coming over the fence into somebody's garden. And it was growing into a sort of cultural conflict. There was a sort of racist dimension to it. The activists spotted that, went and talked to both neighbours, arranged for them to meet in a conference, brought other people like the Eastern European Community Association and the Residents Association together, and got them talking. And they came to a deal about how they were going to live together. The community then said, look, we want to welcome Eastern Europeans to our community. We're going to have a festival in a couple of weeks' time. Please come, join our barbecue, bring your sausages, etc. And so it solved the neighbourhood, the neighbours' dispute, but actually integrated the new community into the larger community in a very positive way. And that's something that the police had been called in, but there was no crime had been. So they couldn't do it. The system couldn't engage with it. So This is the other great thing. And I think it applies also to New Zealand, because I think you have the Maori population, you have others who have informal ways of dealing with conflict. So I think that that's a great sense of hope, that we can actually deal with a lot of difficult situations, nip them in the bud before they get serious and before you need to bring the sort of heavy mob in. And by activating community, by training people within the community to look out for problems and intervene in a positive way, you can reduce a lot of antisocial behavior, hate crime, conflict. And that's what we found in our study.
Have you ever been the victim of a crime?
Yeah, yes, I have, yeah. I sometimes tell this to my students. I was, many years ago, I was on holiday in Sicily. And myself and my partner were mugged in the street. There's a little bit of a struggle. Ironically, she got hurt, I didn't. And it was interesting for me, this liberal, restorative sort of guy, to observe it, my own reaction. First, terrible revenge fantasies, what I would have done to those two young fellas if I'd got them. And secondly, when I got back to Belfast, like thousands of miles from Sicily, for about 6 months, and this wasn't like me, I was checking doors and windows. I had an insecurity. Those two things faded. But what didn't fade was, I'm never going back to Sicily. I did not want, and I love Italy. I go to Italy all the time. So it wasn't a huge sacrifice. Sicily's only one part. But track forward about 20 years, I'm over as a visiting professor in Italy, working with some colleagues in academia on restorative justice. And their project is with a prison in the middle of Sardinia, high security prison for the mafia. And they asked me to come and do what we call a restorative circle with the mafiosi. And I walk in, and there's about 20 of them, and the leader, Il Capo, comes up to me to greet me before I start, and we're having, where have you come from, Belfast? Well, that's very nice. And I said, where are you from? And he says, Catania in Sicily. And I said, without thinking, I said, that's a place I'm never going to go to. And I told him the story about being mugged. And he was, oh, well, I'm very sorry, it's my town, but I've got to say, I'm not surprised. This is the sort of thing we do in Catania. And it turned out in this group, there was about five or six from Catania. Anyway, we had a very good discussion about restorative justice, taking responsibility for things. And some of these prisoners had done awful things. The mafia, they'd killed people. They stood up and said, look, I couldn't tell you what I did. I'm ashamed. And I deserve to be here. And I don't know how I can do what you're asking me to do, is to make amends, to say I'm sorry to my victims, and also to make amends to my family who I've let down. So it was a very positive, constructive conversation. And at the end, when we were winding up, again, I found myself saying to them, without thinking, I tell you what, I'm going to make a commitment. This has been restorative to me. You remember I told you about being mugged and not wanting to go to your city? Next summer, I'm going to have a holiday in Sicily, and I'm going to go to Catania. Ah, oh, bravo, bravo. One of them put his hand up and says, Professore, if you go to Catania, we can offer you protection, you know. I go home, tell my wife, next year we're going to Sicily. She says, I thought you'd never wanted to go to Sicily. I said, oh, I told her the story, and she says, oh, so the mafia are now deciding where we go on holiday. So we did. I got a photograph taken in Catania, and it was.
Did you have protection?
No. Uh-huh. And I sent it into the prison. But that is, it reminds me that if you are a victim and it isn't resolved, it sticks with you.
You carry prejudice.
Yeah, you can, and it also restricts you. I mean, it's not a big deal not to go to Sicily, but you imagine your other victims, and of other things. The story of what happens to you continues to dominate you in some way. Mm. You don't have the same control over your life. Mm. For me, it was a silly thing. I'm not going to have a holiday in Sicily. Mm. That's not a big hardship. But then by meeting the people that you perceive as to be the perpetrators of the harm and realizing they're just human beings, you think, let it go. You know, what's the point? And I had a great holiday in Sicily.
Mm.
Yeah. And I've been there since.
What What you seem to be saying is that our apprehension of danger is usually exaggerated, becomes irrational by our experience. Mm. But that is not necessarily the case. There are some places that are dangerous that you'd be foolish to go to.
Oh, absolutely.
No matter how many nice people you met from that place that shook your hand and were terribly decent people. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I think what I'm saying is crime harms people and it causes suffering. Part of that suffering is in your imagination because you begin to imagine who did it. And we have, in our culture, we have some stereotypes of what an offender is, a cruel, heartless, aggressive, violent person who's very dangerous. And so that plays in our mind. So that story about what happened is partly in our imagination and partly reality. And what a meeting the person does is help you sort out what is true and what is not true.
Either way.
And the truth could be, and I've had this, that, for instance, a woman who had been abused by her father sexually went to meet him before he came out of prison. And it was clear he hadn't changed. She didn't explain exactly how she knew, but she said, when I came in, he embraced me, and the embrace was not a father's embrace, whatever that meant, but there was a sexual connotation to it. So she, and I felt awful, but she said, I'm glad I did it, because if I hadn't done that, when he came out, because he's still my father and I still have feelings for him, I might have invited him round to my house. He might have met my daughters. Now I know that's never going to happen. So I know something. So sometimes you discover something negative, but that's also useful in order to manage the risk in your life. Usually, it's more likely you'll discover something positive that makes you feel much more relaxed about what's happened. But victims are not all vulnerable, you know, sort of weak people. You know, there's victims that are very strong and they deserve to know what's the reality so they can make their own decisions on how to cope with it.
That was Tim Chapman. He is an expert in restorative justice from Northern Ireland. He addressed a conference in New Zealand this past week.